Welcome everybody to the October 6th, 2022 meeting of Energy, Environment, and Sustainability Committee. And would the clerk kindly call the roll?
Yes. Chairwoman Manajo Green?
Present.
Deputy Chair Gina Hansett?
Present.
Legislator Phil Erner? Legislator Joseph Maloney? Legislator Eric Stewart.
Present.
Okay. And I'd like to ask folks to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And have folks had a chance to review the minutes of the September 8th meeting? I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Okay. Doug. Very good. All in favor of approving the minutes from September 8th? Anyone opposed? Okay, motion carries. And with that, I would like to welcome Greg Olivier. Am I saying that right?
You said that perfect.
Okay, great. And ask if you would introduce yourself, and then Tim will give a brief overview of the budget that is our committee reviews. So please come
hey,
to the
Anna, this is Phil. Sorry to interrupt.
I had a question
about the minutes that you all just approved.
He has a question about the minutes you just approved?
Yes.
What's your question?
As I had reviewed the minutes, there was a question I had asked in the minutes about the position of county engineer to be specified and that Director Doyle's study would contact the Department of Public Works to get an answer. I'm wondering if that, this was about resolution number 472. And I'm wondering if that had happened in the final version that we passed. If anybody knows, we can research this offline perhaps as well. But
Phil,
it was supposed to be. Yeah.
I'm going to suggest that you bring that up. We can deal with that retroactively when you're here. We can't do it by phone, if I understand correctly. Essentially, you're.
No problem.
Thank you. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I want to. Handle it that way. I think that's the appropriate way to handle it. Okay. And with that, if you would please tell us a little bit. Why don't we introduce ourselves? Well, you heard when the roll was called, but why don't you introduce yourself and then we'll introduce ourselves and take it from there.
Okay. So, as you said, my name is Greg Olivier, and I am the new executive director for UCRRA. This is my first week, started on Monday. And so I am drowning right now in a lot of information coming at me, but we're just going to keep struggling through that, and we'll get it. I'm hearing a lot of positives and of a lot of potential challenges and stuff coming my way, so just eager to kind of make my rounds as I can and meet with individuals and gain some perspective and get the input I can get so that I can figure out how to best to serve this county in my role as the executive director over there. To give you some perspective of my background, I've been in the waste industry for over 30 years, was in pre-law and working a job to pay for school and live, and was thrust into the waste industry, and it sidelined my whole plans for my future, and I didn't end up going to law school and ended up doing this instead. So have been here doing it for a long time in California, and if you think you have regulations here, you have nothing. Believe me, California is way ahead of you when it comes to creating regulation for waste. Most of it doesn't work, unfortunately, but they are great at creating it. So they are creating a lot of it. So anyhow, I've been dealing with it for a lot of years, and both from the public sector and the private sector. And so I bring the perspective of both sides of the table to what I do. And I'd be happy to, like I said, sit down and discuss the challenges here with anybody that is interested in bending my ear on them. So.
And I'll ask that other people, as they give reports, introduce themselves. But for now, the committee, starting with Deputy Hansett.
Gina Hansett in District 10 Legislature. I'm down in the southern end of the county, Highland and Marlboro.
I think getting into a contract today for a house in Highland. So.
Oh, very good.
We may be in your neck of the woods.
That's awesome. We'll get you registered to vote.
My name is Eric Stewart, and I'm a county legislator. I represent the towns of Marbletown and Hurley, and I've had the pleasure of meeting your wife on several occasions.
You're the gentleman that she meets as she walks the dogs?
Yes.
and your dog?
Yes. Correct? I'm the one out in my bathrobe in the morning.
Okay. Yeah. She said, somebody you're going to end up working with, I've already met. And I was like, okay. And then she was telling me about a dog. And
yes. Okay. So you're moving from being my neighbor to being...
Yes, that's hopefully going to happen. Yes. Nothing against your neighborhood. It's beautiful, but it's a ways out there.
It's lovely, but it is, like you said, out there. So, yes. Yeah.
And why don't we just go around and say name and title?
I'm Dave Gordon. I'm a legislative counsel, and as I mentioned, I was a former board member of the agency.
Okay. So you're going to be full of information for me.
One step at a time. I'll help where I can.
Dave Haldeman, I'm chair of the Ulster County Environmental Council.
Okay. I'm Ashley Long. I'm the project manager for the Recovery and Resilience Division.
Nick Moss, I'm the director of the Department of Environment for the county.
Dennis Doyle, I'm the planning director for the county.
Mark Ryder, deputy county executive.
I'm Chelsea Villalba, legislative staff.
Okay. And I'm Fawn Tiantillo, legislative staff.
Okay, great.
All right, I'm going to hand out some budget highlights, copies of our actual operating budget, and then also our capital plan, because the capital plan ties into our operating budget. We got four down that way. Pass the rest around there. I know some people are new to this, so just make you aware, the very first thing that I do is come up with an estimate for what our tons are going to be for the year, because the tons are our revenue and our cost driver. About 90% of our revenue is based on, you know, tipping fees on those tons, and about 75-80% of our costs are based on tons as well, so that's where I start. The tipping fee per ton is going to, we have a proposal that the board approved. We have a public hearing on October 13th at 4 o'clock at the agency main office. We're proposing to go up $5 a ton from $105 a ton to $110 a ton. This will actually be the first increase that we've had since 2020. Transportation and disposal costs have increased almost $7 a ton since 2020. I have a list here of some of the comparative tipping fees from surrounding counties like Orange County. Is at 121, and these are current rates for them. 121.25 a ton. Sullivan is 110 a ton. Green is 115 a ton, and Columbia County is $140 a ton. Ton adjustments are based on a four-year average. It includes a 2022 estimate, so the rest of this year I basically estimate, take the prior three-year actuals, and come up with an average. So that I don't, it's hard to predict tons as it is, but you don't want to just go off what the current situation is either. So I trend back a couple years. Yep. Sorry.
Just want to ask, Sullivan County still have an operating landfill?
Mm-mm.
No.
Mm-mm.
So they're all exporting.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I don't know if you remember the Gus study that we had done. That was a part of that study that they're exporting. Yep.
Thank you.
Our compost revenues are based on ton adjustments over the previous 3 to 4 years, like brush, food waste, compost sales, with no proposed increase in rates, and now includes bag compost sales. Our bag compost took a little bit longer to get it going, but we've been working with our website provider so that we can do e-commerce right through the website. So we're in beta testing right now, trying to work that out, work out the kinks. I have to do this budget right in July, August time frame, and unfortunately recycling commodities are a market, and you never know what's going to happen. I did propose an increase in sale of recyclables, which was expected at the time, 2 months ago, and it's based on current year actuals, my numbers, but the markets have since declined. OCC 3 months ago was around $150 and $120 a ton. We just got word that we're already down to $15 a ton right now, so. If you think predicting volume on garbage, it's tough. Try figuring out the markets and, 18 months in advance. On the expenditure side, salaries and wages are increasing due to raises and staffing increases. Administration expenses have increased in prior years because they now more accurately reflect our most recent actuals. Transportation costs include contractual increases of 90 cents a ton for MBI, who was the company that hauls out of our Ulster facility, and $1.17 a ton for Godadu, which hauls out of our New Paltz facility. Solid waste disposal costs include a contractual increase of $1.33 a ton, and that's for our waste that is tipped at Seneca Meadows landfill. Glass disposal costs are expected this year, and sludge costs, there's a decrease, and that's related to a volume decrease netted with a contractual increase of $1.50 a ton. For those who don't know, our sludge does go down to Rockland County to their composting facility, so that does not get landfilled. We do have an operating reserve transfers in, and also from our contingency account. The agency did not transfer in from our contingency accounts for the operating reserve in the current year due to increased volume. So since we didn't need those budgeted transfers, we're moving them ahead to 2023. Anyone have any questions? Any answers?
Neither, right?
I always encourage anyone, if you do have any questions, you email me, call me, or whatever. This is my 16th, 17th budget, so, at the agency. Time goes fast. I was pretty happy this year too. Our board got together and did a full blown budget workshop, where I put my spreadsheet on the projector screen and we worked through it. They suggested changes, and they could see actually how everything filtered through and the changes to the bottom line. And they were able to, constructively work together and come to an agreement on where the tipping fee could be.
So the budget has been approved by the board?
It's been approved. So the way we have to do it, it's got to go out as part of the contract with the towns. It's got to go out to them so that they can put their budgets together as well. And we have to give a certain amount of notification to them so that they can, so the public can come to our public hearing as well. So they have approved a proposed tipping fee and budget, but it won't be formally approved until our October 27th meeting, which is 2 weeks after the public hearing on the 13th.
And just to be clear on the role, in general, the agency is autonomous in many ways, mm-hmm. but there are still, and I just want to check in the, agreement signed in 2000 that goes through 2005, the agreement between the agency and the county, does that say that the UCRA budget needs to, or an agreement since then, needs to come to the legislature? We don't have to approve it, but we have to receive it.
When I start, it's the 92 agreement that runs out in 2025. When I started there, we actually used to present, I don't know what the name of the committee was before the charter.
Right.
I just remember Hector and Steve Wing arguing over all the time over about recycling. But we used to formally present to them and have a full-blown meeting. When the charter came along, we just send it off to the county exec's office instead. But I've always, Tim Rose at the time and myself, always thought it was prudent to bring it to this committee as well. So we've always continued to do that too. But there's nothing explicit because that agreement is so kind of stale dated, especially with terminology and verbiage with regards to, before the charter form of government coming in.
The charter and also since then flow control.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So What I was trying to get at is whether or not we needed to take any action or just receive the information.
Nope.
And if I could just add, I think one of the biggest pieces that we look at when we see it is that and every year there's not a net service.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's part of the flow control is that, you know, they could charge the county a net service fee.
Correct.
It's not been required.
Since 2012.
Right.
Yep. And I usually use the first person. I send an email to Bert. Tell him, you can put a zero in there, buddy. Right. So, yep.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yep.
Any questions or comments?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I'd like to Director Nick Basta from the Department of Environment to give an update. And it's also my understanding that between now and next month, we would want to look at the budget for the Department of Environment. Is that so? Not tonight, but I just want to give you a heads up.
It'll be presented formally, the actual budget, on Friday, tomorrow. And so next month, then, yeah, it would make sense for Nick to come back and do a budget presentation.
Okay, thank you.
This meeting next month. Great.
And Nick, please speak up because I have.
Of course.
Exacerbated hearing problems tonight.
We have a new staff member at the department as of the past, I guess, 3 weeks ago. Her name's Michelle Gluck. She's a senior environmental resource technician, and she's backfilling Europa McGovern's position that was vacated when she took the deputy director position in the department. She's coming to us from Cornell Cooperative Extension in Dutchess County, where she has a lot of experience with a wide variety of environmental topics. And for us, she'll be focusing primarily on climate action work, both greenhouse gas inventories, climate action planning, and then implementation of climate action plans.
Nick, I'm sorry, what was her name again?
Michelle Gluck.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And will she also be able to participate in the Climate Smart Committee? Would that come under? Have you sorted that out?
I think the primary attendee will continue to be Europa.
Okay.
But when needed, she'll sub in.
Great. Thank you.
She was closely involved with the Dutchess County Environmental Management Council in her prior role, so she's comfortable with that. Arrangement. So, as of last week, we sent mailings to the regulated generators for the Food Waste Prevention and Recovery Act, who will be regulated starting on January 1st. This is anyone who's estimated to have 0.75 tons per week of food waste or greater. It's 81 entities, and we're now doing site visits, doing phone calls, outreach and education about the law to all of those entities over the next couple of months.
Is that 81 additional from what is current, or is that bringing the total to 81?
The total is 81, yeah. So it's, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I think it was about 40 combined of previously regulated entities who are carried forward to this year. But we're now getting into a good number of restaurants and some folks who are not expecting it. So,
I have a question that came up. Legislator Stewart and I met with the superintendent of schools for Roundout Valley. And a question that's come up, and other people have asked me, and I haven't gone back and looked at the letter of the law, but for a school district, would it be the combined of all the facilities, or it would be 0.75 tons per week for each facility?
Right now, we're looking at facility by facility.
Okay, great. So we can get back to. They were.
So in other words, it's the middle school and the. Yeah. Okay.
Each,
great.
For each facility, and they were very favorably responsive. So. He's actually had experience before he came to Roundup Valley. So, and there is a network evolving of communication between educators and school districts on waste reduction, energy issues, and curricula. So we should see some good progress in the next year.
Interestingly, the there's only one school that made the cut for 3/4 of a ton per week or greater, which is Ellenville Elementary. And we looked at a couple of different methodologies for determining that, but that's the one. And then next year, when we get down to 0.5 ton, there will be 5 or 6 within the county.
And Ellenville Hospital is already prior to the law. So
we'll have to get them together to share notes. Last thing I have, we have a pending community climate action planning process that we received grant funding for last year from the DEC. The contracting process with the DEC has been protracted, mainly on the DEC's end, but we should we should have a contract signed with them hopefully within the next month, and then be doing procurement for a consultant to lead that process for us late this year, early next year.
And could I ask you also for an update on the Reuse Innovation Center?
Yes. I believe the contract with Sustainable Hudson Valley is signed, or else it's very nearly signed. And we're starting discussions with Sustainable Hudson Valley to do initial stakeholder meetings and start kicking off the project.
And I just want to be sure, Greg, are you familiar with that? You know, just so you know who's who and who's working on what. Last year we bookmarked in the capital budget up to $75,000 to do a feasibility study for a reuse innovation center, and the Department of Environment is shepherding that project to fruition. So I just wanted to, with your information overload, I'm trying to help clarify, not add to it.
Yeah, I had what I referred to as the executive director education series one meeting with Angie yesterday, and that was part of what I was kind of enlightened on a little bit, is what was going on with this and stuff. So the staff has been feeding me as much as I can take in, and then board members are also adding to that. I'm reading quite a few emails, and I got your email, and I don't know if I replied or not, but I did get it. I've been trying to wade through all of this stuff and reply where I can. So no, I appreciate it. Any clarification that I can be given, I'll take. I might have to hear it 3 times before it sinks in, too. So
you have to do something 6:30.
Yes. Let's see. I'm going to, just for 5 minutes, ask if Gina will entertain the report from the Management Council. I have to step out of the room and step right back. I'm kind of multitasking, and I apologize, but it's necessary. So, Deputy Hansen, if you would kindly take it from here for a moment.
Sure. So, for that EMC update?
Sure. Usually I don't say much, but I've got a couple things tonight to mention. There is some turnover in the members coming from the various communities to the EMC right now. There are 3 long-term members who are not going to renew after many, many years of service. And I'll mention their names, but I'd also like this committee to send them a letter of thanks, if that would be possible. That'd be Mary O'Donnell out of Saugerties, Emily Hauser out of Kingston, and Jim Mays, who was an at-large member.
Absolutely.
So that would be nice.
Could you send us an email with their contact information?
Oh, well now, okay. Email contact. Got it, I'm sorry. Mary and Emily already have replacements. So that's from Sagarita and Kingston. We also had new members attend for the first time from Highland in the town of New Paltz. And the town of Shandokan now has an environmental council and is anticipated to send a representative as well. We're still missing people from Woodstock and Rosendale, unfortunately.
And Marbletown. And Marbletown.
You're there sometimes.
I'm there sometimes.
And Marbletown.
I'm trying to get a full-time person.
Just a point of interest, perhaps, and that is that I happen to be on the railroad station in Secaucus, New Jersey, several weeks ago, and it was covered with spotted lanternflies. I mean, covered. I could count 25, all dead, but all there. So, and we know that it's into Rockland, I believe, and it's coming. And these are pretty devastating, invasive, moth-like things. They're about yay big. They're pretty. They got a sort of pink back with black little spots on them, and they look wonderful. However, they're very, very destructive of all sorts of plants. One thing I brought up, and this is just for your consideration, possibly in the future for a future law for the county, I have been impressed with or devastated by the numbers of warehouses going up here, there, and everywhere. Large, 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 taking up acres, each one. And here you've got a building, many times on prime farmland, but other than that, that is open space, basically, with a flat roof. I sure would like to see some type of legislation that would at least suggest that those buildings should be built so that solar could be placed on top of those buildings. And I don't know whether it can be enforced or not, but at least to that extent. I mean, here you've got a perfect spot that's going to be sitting there on top of a flat roof building that has no obstruction. It should be able to be done. The only other thing I wanted to mention, and that's just about committee meetings for you legislators, being on the environmental committee, driving an hour tonight and an hour back, and I do have a solar car, fully solar. However, many of my members traveling to meetings, we're using gas-powered vehicles to go a long distance. There was a point in time during COVID where we were allowed at least to have hybrid meetings, which meant that we did have a facility that was open, that was staffed with Nick or myself or several people, other outside people who wanted to be there could. The rest of the meeting was taking place on Zoom. And I certainly would ask your consideration that law be changed or that directive be changed for most committees because, I mean, if we're really serious about climate, then having us travel all these distances doesn't make a lot of sense.
I mean, unfortunately, yeah. It's just the allowance to do that was an executive order by the governor, and she
so
let
it's a state problem,
lapse.
It's not us.
So, because of open meetings law, the county legislature can't actually
right.
do that.
We had talked about that in
state.
Another committee because some of them are not that lengthy, and it is a drive, but it is her discretion, and she ended that. It's not up to us, unfortunately.
And there's no course other than letters and so forth and so on to appeal that.
Right. I mean, it's a process. I mean, we can, you know, but...
Okay.
I agree.
That's clarification. I appreciate
agree.
It.
So.
Phil on stack here.
Phil wanted to speak. Phil?
Thank you. I did talk with Clerk Capella just today about this, and there's other reasons that, as well, that for enfranchising more of the public to be able to attend remotely, and she had some ideas of how we might be able to accommodate that despite the current state law. And we actually had sent a, we passed a resolution last month that has to still get certified by the Secretary of State, but that will somewhat liberalize the circumstances under which we can do some more things remotely. So I think all is not without hope or beyond our power to do what Mr. Haldeman is asking.
And I agree, and I think it is a valid point and moving forward, but currently it is out of our jurisdiction, but thank you.
And I, if I may, I also spoke with Chair Bartels, and particularly for the Climate Smart, because we have people all over the county that should not have to drive to this room to be able to network and participate. So the possibility is that the appointed members would be present and that the others could Zoom in. And so that's, it's being worked on. And hopefully we might be able to figure out something interim. When we were on full Zoom, we would have 15 or 20 people from around the county sharing information, learning from each other. And literally none of the people came to our last meeting in person. We want to see if there's a way to address that. And if the state law has to be modified, we're not above suggesting that. Because telecommuting is a climate solution. And so we want to take advantage of that without disenfranchising the public. Okay, where are we?
That was the only thing we got. Was,
anything else from environmental management? Okay.
Not really. I'll just mention that I was just recently overseas in Denmark for a few days, and they're 100 to 110% totally renewable, exporting the extra to Norway, Sweden, Denmark. Just mostly off of wind, huge wind, offshore wind, and some solar, but mostly wind. And among other things, they all bike everywhere too. I mean,
yeah.
But
a little later on the agenda is reissuing a resolution declaring a climate emergency and listing actions that we can take, and that's a full discussion. But one of those is to achieve the state's goals within Ulster County of 70% renewable energy generation here in Ulster County, 70% of what we collectively consume. So how to get from here to there is another story, but if we make a commitment, it's more likely we will get there. So, okay. At this point, I would like to entertain, discuss the resolutions, and the first resolution before us this evening is Resolution 494, supporting the Clean Water, Clean Air, and Green Jobs Bond Act of 2022. I would entertain a motion for discussion.
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion?
Phil and Stack.
Phil would like to speak.
Okay. Go ahead, Phil.
Thank you. I just for the public who might have scanned this quickly, we're declaring our support for this measure here, but it will actually be up to the voters in November to adopt it.
That's absolutely correct and a good, helpful clarification. So this is a memorializing resolution. It is indeed up to the voters. Any other discussion? I will say that I think it's passed other committees already, if I'm not mistaken, Public Works and... not to influence your... But at this point, I'd like to call the question. All in favor of resolution number 494, supporting the Environmental Bond Act of 2022.
Aye.
Please indicate. Anyone opposed? Okay, motion carries. And then the next one is resolution number 497, amending the 2022-27 capital improvement program, increasing funding for capital project number 642, ARPA, homeowners, energy improvement, and job training project. And amending the capital fund budget, Department of Finance. And I want to really thank Director Doyle for taking a lot of information and putting it together in a way that really makes sense. And I'm going to, I might have some notes on here, just ignore them. But in case anyone has not seen, I think you folks got this as backup, but I'm just going to pass it around so that if anyone's interested, they can look at the details. And I think the bottom line is the last page. And basically, this can put us in line for future funding because we're doing it not only to achieve the energy efficiency and greenhouse gas reductions for the families involved, but it'll be done as a study of before and after and a jobs training program in cooperation with Communities for Local Power, RUPCO, and area contractors who already have been doing extensive job training with the Empower Kingston program, and this will create, it'll expand that program. So here I'm starting to discuss without even asking for a motion for to put this on the floor.
So moved.
Okay, second. Is there any further discussion?
I was just going to say that I think that this kind of hits so many, you know, touches on so many bases that we're working on. I mean, it deals with climate justice, it deals with renewable energy and energy efficiency, it deals with education and job training. I think it's a very worthwhile project for us to pursue.
It's a huge investment, but it is the investment that the Inflation Reduction Act, it's one of the main things that that act will be funding. So by doing this ahead of the availability of those funds, we'll have a track record. Okay.
And I just have a question as well. Has it passed these? I mean, has it passed all of these committees, or where does it stand?
Except ARPA. And it will be going to ARPA before the legislation, before session.
Okay.
But if Ways and Means is on there, it has not passed Ways and Means yet.
That's right.
It has passed Public Works.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
And I think that's the only one so far. Or it was in economic development.
It's in economic development.
So it's past economic development and public works.
Okay. Thank you for that.
You could think of a few more committees to send it to. I think.
Dennis loves.
Because you enjoy attending all those meetings. Yes. Okay.
All right. Any Any other discussion? I'd like to call the question on resolution four. I'm sorry.
Phil has legislator Erner has a question.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Green, as you pointed out, the new name for Citizens for Local Power is Communities for Local Power. I would recommend that the committee amend the language of the resolution to reflect that new name. It's in the fifth whereas, line two.
Do I hear a motion from the committee members present to do so?
I'm not sure that that's been finalized. So
I thought that had already been done.
I know that we had a conversation with Citizens for Local Power. I know that they had filed for that. I'm not sure whether it's completed, Phil, but I mean, why don't we do that my suggestion would be is do that on the basis that we can confirm that the name change has actually been made official. I know that they moved to do it. I don't know whether it's completed.
Okay, great. And so is there a motion to amend Resolution 497 pending clarification?
I'll make that motion.
Okay. Legislator Stewart, second.
Yes.
Legislator Hansett. All in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay. All in favor of the resolution as amended? Anyone opposed? Okay. Motion carries. And that's it for the resolution.
Dennis, can you check on that?
I will. I'll get a hold of it.
Is there any new business? And I know that some of the issues that Legislator Erner had raised by email, I believe, are going to be postponed till when he's here in person. In terms of old business, we can get through as much of that as possible. And let's see. I'll just check the time. Okay, good. We have. It looks like we're going to get through this agenda. So, under old business, we have started to address a resolution to redeclare a climate emergency with very specific actions. The climate emergency declaration, I believe, was 2019, and things have unfortunately changed considerably. Those poles are melting faster than was previously expected, and so part of the reason for doing this is to address that accelerated process, but the other part is to really identify actions. And I want to thank Fawn and Chelsea for taking a lot of information and putting it into a document that will be the background for actually creating a resolution. And also attached to that is a draft of a resolution that Legislator Petit had recommended, and that is all being woven into a document that I expect is going to take several meetings and, you know, thinking things through. And I think something of this importance should ultimately, even though we're not required to hold a public hearing, I think we probably will want to hear from stakeholders widely on this, because this will embody at least the things that we know now we want to try to achieve in the short term, medium term, and there may be some things that we want to recommend for the long term but don't have enough information, or there isn't a market in place for a given material, or, you know, that's long term. So with that, I don't know if the committee members have had a chance to look through. There's a list of reasons for the new resolution, and those would all be listed as, or as many as are appropriate would be listed as the whereases. But then what we tried to do with, oh, and then there's also a list of actions that have already been taken. I'm not sure that would have to go into the resolution, but it does inform the conversation. And it's pretty substantial. I mentioned that. Especially for Greg's sake, because some of the things that we've done here in Ulster County have become model for the state. For example, bringing your own bag, and other pieces of legislation. In fact, the composting legislation was developed here kind of in parallel with the state legislation, and ours is more comprehensive, appropriate to this county. So then the next is, we try to list the actions by topic. And the first topic is energy. And I just want to ask the committee members if they have comments, things they want to add.
One thing we might want to add is efforts that have been put forth to encourage EV chargers. Would that come under this category, or would that be under a different, would that be under transportation?
That's a good question. It could go either. I see there's one or two that
actually, I'm sorry, it is addressed under transportation, so.
It is in?
Yes.
Okay,
so,
great.
My apologies.
So can we look this over, since there's so much, and then
yes.
Put our questions together?
And bring it back.
Yeah, break it apart, rather than.
Rather than subject everyone else to our little.
And there's a lot here, so,
Can I make one suggestion as well?
Yes, please.
I mean, we have, you know, a Green New Deal action plan that has about 44 separate actions, and I would just recommend that somebody cross-reference whatever's here
That's
with the Green New Deal action plan so that we can basically codify the Green New Deal into this.
Perfect. Excellent suggestion. And are those also listed by topic?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I just want to, I noticed the first achieve 80% waste diversion by prevention, reuse, repair, redesign, deconstruction, composting, or recycling by 2025. So that comes under materials management, and I just thought I'd. And this is very draft. It's going to go wherever it needs to go for stakeholder input before it actually gets acted upon. But I just noticed that. And then site and build a countywide landfill to reduce transportation and greenhouse gas emissions. This can include monofills, etc. I don't see a date in there yet, but if you folks, when processing this, would like to recommend one,
2024, I think, is
welcome that information.
Next Thursday.
Next Thursday.
You only
need you know, I
yesterday.
Don't, I mean, California is next to impossible to cite and permit a new landfill, so New York ought to be easy. I mean, I think maybe give me a day or two and we'll get it done. You know, we've done a few in California. They're a nightmare. So,
see. And The main thing is that if we really achieve waste diversion, including detoxifying the material that's going into a landfill, removing things like sheetrock, which add to hydrogen sulfide and odors. We already have a very extensive Food Waste Prevention and Recovery Act. And the more we divert, the less truck traffic there is. And then we also have to really think about a fair host community benefit package.
Not to mention all the fuel that's saved by carting waste to Seneca Meadows.
Yes, to the tune of $8 to $9 million a year.
Probably over $10 million in the 2023 budget.
So, and all the greenhouse gases associated with that. And then there's some for buildings, land use, agriculture, and materials management. We should move those first down under materials management. Those first couple bullets under. Sorry. These are the proposed actions, these two down under.
Okay. Chelsea, do you have another copy of that?
And I can.
I do not.
Okay. And then a discussion.
Okay,
thank you.
Of resilience and other topics, and very good suggestion to cross reference it. And a list of reference materials and other suggestions. Okay. Anything more?
Questions?
One thing I'll mention is the this process that you're describing is it aligns very well with the community climate action planning process that we proposed for the DEC project that we'll be embarking in over the next year. So I'm looking forward to comparing notes and bringing in a lot of the actions that are developed here into that plan. And then at the end of that project, our intent is to recommend that for adoption to the legislature as the Ulster County Community Climate Action Plan.
So depending on the timeline, we could either make that recommendation in the resolution, or if you're ready first, we can cite that as a whereas.
Absolutely. We can publish the climate emergency resolution in the plan as a
and
the driving.
I really appreciate the fact policy that this county is as active as it is in addressing the global climate crisis. Most of us have younger generation, whether it's children or grandchildren or nieces, nephews, that deserve our attention to this. So I'm very grateful. And we'll have a more informed discussion. And please send Chelsea any other ideas. And Chelsea and Fawn will look at the document that is existing. All right. We're making good progress.
Phil here on deck.
Yes, please. And you're right on time because we're about to go into the speaker training, and it would be really valuable for you to hear that. And this is being recorded, correct? Yes. If there's a way of separating out this training, and by the way, if anybody needs to leave, you do not have to stay for the whole meeting, but you're most welcome. a lot of. Oh, Phil, you're on stack. Go ahead. Legislator Erna?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so it worked out for me that I couldn't be there, that it sounds like we're introducing the climate emergency redeclaration and taking more time to study it and make comments. I have done a once over and have many comments to share, but given the direction, I will reserve almost all of those for a future discussion. I did, though, just want to agree with the idea and add to what Director Bosda was saying about the Community Climate Action Plan. I do believe that this measure that we ultimately adopt will be the strongest it can be by bringing in all of the, as many members of the public as possible to this process, and particularly people who are experts on the topics we're talking about, who can be found among the people of Ulster County. So who am I talking about? Folks who are doing creative things around building homes and growing food in different ways, and public transportation, and ways of consuming less. Now, there is a history in the lands that are now Ulster County of a more communal stewarding of the land from the first peoples who lived here before Europeans came. Today, some of descendants of the First Nations remain around, and also folks who are poorer than average in our county tend by socioeconomic necessity to engage, in my experience at least, in more communal practices than average. And so I think if we really reach out from our position in the government to some of the, for lack of another term, we'll say disadvantaged underclasses in our county, we'll see how people have had to make do with less, and maybe that can inform what we legislate for everybody. I have some concern about whether we are too focused on the public sector and what the government itself does to the detriment of looking at what private individuals, but especially corporations, are doing in our county. And I would like to see what we can legislate and mandate that the wealthy and powerful do in consideration of the crisis that we're trying to address too. In other words, it's not going to be enough, in my opinion, that we simply get the government doing the right thing, but we also have to change the culture, which involves the rest of what's going on in Ulster County as well. And so I would like us to think as carefully and creatively as we can about that. Thank you.
And again, I think that's what we're just talking about, right? That we're going to look at it all and bring it back. And
exactly. And I was going to also recommend, you know, as to be as specific in defining the action and the timeline as possible. And it may not end up being exactly what each person recommends, but at least it will get it on the table for discussion. And if this takes a few months, so be it. We want this to be an inclusive and collaborative process. So, and really, yes, please.
The grant funding we have from the DEC for the climate action planning process is $74,000, and a large part of that will be committed to a public outreach stakeholder process. So we're hoping to reach those constituencies that Legislator Erner mentioned, and many others as well. So.
And I want to say the term of art these days is disadvantaged communities, or DACs. Mm-hmm. And I prefer to say priority communities. I think there's a
a little bit of a stigma associated with disadvantage, so you'll sometimes hear me use those side by side. How long is the grant, that the process that you're going through, what's the approximate timeline for that?
12 to 15 months is what we're planning.
Okay. So we may, it's quite possible that we could issue the redeclaration ahead of that, and then refer to that being in progress and to be completed by the end of next year. Okay, great. All right.
Add one brief addition.
Yes.
Can you thank him?
Actually, I'm going to ask that we stop because we have a timeline and a commitment to start at 7. If it's real quick, add it, but then we're really going to focus on CECR for the next half hour.
Yep, it's real quick. I just want the committee to consider, given the urgency of what this climate emergency declaration is, and not to want the failure to come to consensus about what needs to be done to hold us back. I want us to consider if we are able to come up with a little something each month, that we consider adopting that piecemeal and just recognize that it's part of the larger effort to address the climate emergency. That's all. Thank you.
So instead of trying to put it all together, take sort of the low-hanging fruit and then add to it as needed.
That's the suggestion, yes.
Okay, thank you. And with that, I would like to ask Attorney Gordon if he would do a basic training for us, so much that requires CEQA requires consideration under the State Environmental Quality Review Act comes before this committee, and ultimately it may be that everything does. Everything that has a CEQA determination affiliated with it. And I find it's easy to just assume that all the work and thinking that went into it getting to our committee means that it's ready, but we really do have a serious responsibility, and that's why we've asked Attorney Gordon to help us to understand what we should be looking for and understanding as it comes to energy, environment, and sustainability.
Okay. Preparatory to this meeting, I know that Fawn suggested to me, at Manna's suggestion, at the chair's suggestion, a series of workshops or a series of training sessions for you guys, and I took a look at them and decided that any one of them would serve the purpose for which they were presented, but they didn't thrill me because they were basically very, very dry walkthroughs of the regulations, which is actually most of the trainings you're going to get in one form or another. I'm not sure if you guys had a chance to partake of those. I'm not sure if it was even sent out to you because it kind of told the chair that you can send them out, but they're not going to watch for more than 15 minutes. And so what I'm proposing to do is to not do that. We can circle back to those regulations. You've probably heard them before at some training or other within the context of a particular resolution. We will do that at some point, but we will not do that first because, again, I don't think it's going to be all that productive to walk you through what it means to be a notice of intent to be lead agency or something like that. What I'm going to do, and this is all time conscious, and again, if we get done really quickly, we can then start on this, but I want to do two things first. I want to, first of all, talk about CEQA generally, what it's all about, so you know that every conversation we have, every decision we make has always got this thing that we're supposed to do, with both legal and also for the benefit of the public, which, and SECR is a very important law for the benefit of the public and your constituents. And then secondly, I want to talk to you a little bit about your day-to-day experience with this, how these issues, whether it be a declaration of significance or a notice of intent to be lead or even just a smaller determination, how it hits you on a day-to-day basis in terms of when you walk in here, when you get your packet, what does it mean? And in that context, what I'm going to try to do is compare you to an agency that most of us are pretty familiar with in terms of being kind of an agency that we see do SECR all the time, which is a town or a municipality planning board. These are the guys that we've seen do this if you've ever gone to a planning board meeting. And I'm going to compare and contrast what happens here as opposed to what happens for a planning board, because it will give you insight into your problems of how to approach the issues that come before you. And then I think that will provide a useful backdrop to the regulations, and if we have time and the inclination, we can walk through them or postpone that for another day if we think it's useful. First, I want to talk about what SECR is broadly and why you're being asked to do it. There's a lot of regulations, there's a lot of procedures, but there's an important purpose, and each procedure, each step in the process should be considered with the purpose in mind. SECR, and before I talk about SECR, I'm going to talk about a different acronym, NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which was the federal law that sort of SECR mimics.
Say that again?
NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. That was one of the first and cornerstone environmental laws that were passed during the great age of environmental legislation in the late 60s and early 70s. It was actually in 1969. It was before all the other law. The Clean Air Act was 1970, the Clean Water Act was 72, the Endangered Species Act was 73. NEPA was before that, because NEPA establishes the policy and procedures that are broadly applicable, and SECR does the same in the state. And the basic idea of NEPA and then SECR, the one thing that we need to keep in mind is that the idea was, if an agency takes an action, and we'll talk about what an action is, but you can making a resolution to do something or to spend money on something or to approve something is functionally an action. Then the agency needs to consider the potential environmental impacts. And in fact, NEPA, which was in 1969, grew out of a Hudson Valley case earlier in the 1960s, which we now know as Storm King Mountain. It was a case where Con Edison, in the early 60s, proposed to put a pump storage facility, a type of power generating facility, on top of Storm King Mountain, which is one of the mountains in the Hudson Highlands, basically outside of Cold Spring. And for those of you who are familiar with the area, West Point, you understand sort of the topography there, the scenery, and those who are familiar with West Point, the history of this area. And this had a very strong reaction in the Hudson Valley, but the federal government approved it anyway, and without considering the two really huge environmental impacts, which would have been the scenery and also to some extent the fish propagation in that part of the river. And there was a court case in 1965. It was the appeals court, federal appeals court for the Second Circuit in New York, which ruled that the government had a responsibility to consider the environmental impact before they approved this. And that was enacted into legislation 4 years later as the National Environmental Policy Act. And 6 years after that, in 1975, it was enacted in New York State as our state's policy. It applies to SECR, applies to all state agencies and all municipal agencies in the state, anything under state jurisdiction, whereas NEPA applies to federal agencies. But it's the same idea. The basic idea is that before an agency takes an action, it must consider the environmental impacts of that action. Now, sometimes this can be seen as superfluous, because the action you're taking, or let's take DEC for example. DEC might be approving a speedies permit, right? A permit for a discharge of wastewater into a body of water. And there's a whole bunch of rules that apply to that. And so SECR, considering the environment, might be superfluous. The two ideas to keep in mind as a response to that is, one, SECR applies in all situations, and if you're sort of doing double duty, then you're doing double duty. It doesn't matter whether the same research applies to two different laws. Secondly, and this is super important, SECR applies to all of the potential environmental impacts. So you have, let's say you have a a sewage treatment plant that's being newly built and is going to have this discharge. Yes, you've got to comply with the SPEDES regulations, but what SECA also says is you've got to look at all of the impacts of this. If the wastewater impacts are being covered and the fish are being covered, great, but is this going to have a visual impact if it's on the river? Is it in the wrong place? Is it going to have an impact on historic resources? Is it going to cause growth and thereby change our patterns of growth? And SECR has a different set of impacts for each project. That might be, for example, a sewage treatment plant. If it was a subdivision, we might have a different set of impacts. Is it going to cause runoff? Is it going to impact an area where an endangered species has a habitat? So the point of SECR is, in some sense, a one-size-fits-all legal overview or legal framework within which every project essentially, and the, more importantly, the lead agency, sort of applies it in a certain way, and it'll be different in every situation. So that's the short background on SECR and what we will hopefully be thinking about every time a SECR question comes up. What you'll find in working with me, to the extent that you do, is I am less of a stickler for certain SECR technicalities. Many people, for example, become very concerned about what's on an environmental assessment form, an EAF, and did they check the box wrong? And there's lots of boxes on an EAF. And in my view, you know, for example, environmental assessment form. It is sort of the most basic information packet that will come to you. Think of it as a SECR application. When we see when you're proposed to do a SECR action, where's the EAF? Otherwise, I don't know what it is. I mean, they can tell us in a written paragraph what it is, but this provides just the facts, ma'am, the how big, how long, what size, what type of project, etc. And the SECR form also has certain diagnostics. You know, is this going to be big? Is that going to be big? But my point is, it's not religion. If they get something wrong on a SECR form, as long as we can find the error, find the problem, and get the point is to get the relevant information to make the best decision. It's not necessarily to worry whether a box is checked correctly. It's good to have the box checked correctly, and we ought to correct it. But I'm going to be much more concerned about, are we doing the fundamental thing that we need to do, getting all the information we need to make sure that if we're going to certify that there's no impact, then we're sure of that. Now, what I want to talk about in this context.
I'm going to assume that we know less than you're assuming.
Okay.
So when you say if we're going to certify, it's not going to be the committee. It's going to be the lead agency that does the certification?
Yes, but the committee is the representative of the lead agency. This is a little bit I was going to get into
this
a little bit.
You're going to get to this.
But okay. No, but let me... This is a good thing that you need to know, because this is going to actually inform the next step here. The lead agency is a technical term for the agency that essentially handles the SECR review, and many projects have more than one agency that have a permitting process or are proposing it. And so you're going to choose a lead agency, but for this purpose, the lead agency is the agency that handles the SECR review. In your context, this is kind of funky because the agency you will call we will call the legislature the lead agency, but the truth is it's the county that's the agency, because the county administration is never, as far as I know, a separate agency in this. Although they will have a great role in this, we are essentially the approving in the same way that the legislature has to approve the resolution to do the project. We are in exactly the same position on SECR. They can make whatever recommendations they want. They can provide the information. Ultimately, we are the ones. By we, I mean the legislature. But this committee is the one that runs interference for the legislature. This committee decides first. We make our recommendations, and then the legislature adopts it. And as a practical matter, in most cases, the legislature will place great weight on what happens in this committee. So we are the primary interference on vetting, essentially evaluating what we hear, and making those decisions. So the legislature is the lead agency, but on behalf of the county as a unitary agency, and that's one of the things that makes your position unique. And that's a great lead into where I'm going.
Specifically the planning board, correct?
The county? Or the
county.
No. No. Specifically the legislature.
Specifically the legislature.
You are, the legislature is the lead agency, and this committee is the one that's first figuring out what the lead agency should do, and then getting it ratification by the full committee. It's the same as any, the same as, when they, let me put this through, when they come, when the county administration, let's say, proposes building a new building, it's going to cost $5 million, whatever, you're going to do two things. One is you're going to approve or not approve or approve and modify their proposal, or recommend, or whatever committee is involved, you and another committee might recommend to the legislature to do that, and you will do the exact same thing on SEACR. You will hear their point of view as to what the environmental impacts are or may be, and you will evaluate that, and you'll make a recommendation on that to the legislature, and the legislature will rule on that, and that will be the determination of the lead agency. So you are essentially, and that's what makes this a little bit funky, frankly, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to compare this to a town planning board, which statutorily you're doing the same things, but you're doing it in a different way that actually impacts how much you know and your freedom to figure things out. And that's what I want to talk about before we get to the, what exactly are these things you're going to be, you know, passing resolutions on.
Quickly, I'm sorry.
Dennis will correct my errors.
No. You're absolutely positively right. I'm trying to give him a simpler way to think of this. At a local level, a local planning board can actually approve an action. Right? Doesn't involve the town board or anything. They can actually approve an action. Right. Think of this at a county level. There is no agency at the county level, whether it be DPW, the county planning board, the health department, or anybody else, that can approve an action without your action. There's some indications under public health law, under your public health law, that the county health department does approve septic systems and stuff like that. They generally do that with the idea that the town has acted first, or that their action is something called ministerial. But when Dave says agency, I want you to think about the fact that you're the agency. No one else. It's your deal.
Acting on behalf, although the impetus for it may come from the county, the administration may have thought this through and decide this is a good idea. We're going to do it this way. We're going to do the studies. They come into it. This is what they want to do. This is why they think it's right. This is why they think it won't have an environmental impact. That's just a proposal. Ultimately, it will be the legislature that ratifies it and that makes it county policy and that complies with the law, both in terms of the underlying action and also the SEACR analysis of that it's not going to have any adverse impact on this or that, or we're going to do an EIS. And that's what a POS deck means. When we get to a declaration of significance, which I'm not going to get too deep in the weeds on that, but that's what that means. Either a neg deck and we're not going to do SEACR anymore, or a POS deck and we're going to do an EIS. I want to, for a moment, compare it to the planning board so you understand sort of what the difference is and why we may actually be going through this in terms of, like, what are we missing. If you were a town planning board, most likely, in most circumstances, the person or the group coming before you is going to be a private applicant. And they might come in here with an EAF. They want to do a subdivision. And when I talk about a planning board, we're talking in particular about site plan approval or subdivision approval, just to keep it simple. This is extremely common, if you're not otherwise familiar with it. The developer is going to come in with an EAF, just the facts, and they may actually come in with one or more studies to show this isn't going to have an impact on traffic. The scenery is going to improve. We're going to make the trees prettier. Here's all our studies. Here's our plan of study, et cetera. They come into us with that, and they want us to take, again, whatever stage we're at. When that happens to a town planning board, the town planning board has an enormous advantage. They can then say, all right, thank you. They can turn to their side, and if they're exercising the proper jurisdiction under their authority, they can hire a consultant, a technical consultant, whatever one they want or more, the planners, the engineers, etc., and a lawyer, which hopefully you do have a lawyer, but in terms of these other consultants, they can say, all right, take a look at this and tell us what more is necessary. First of all, are we procedurally at the right stage? Have they missed something? And secondarily, in terms of what they're telling us on the substance, do we need any more intersections looked at? Have they gotten all the angles right on the visual? Are the runoff calculations done correctly? Are they, all these things? And your consultant at that point, if you're the town planning board, they work for you. You can tell them what to do. You can actually dismiss them if they don't, and therefore they will be very solicitous of you. They will come and say, not only are we answering your questions, we've got our own questions, and they will give you, hopefully, as full of an information on this as frankly, your fees deserve, right? And then you can take that and then you can turn back to the applicant and say, all right, here's what we're going to do. In this situation, the situation usually is that if the administration is coming forward, even though you're legally the same agency and you will act for them and the actions in this committee will be hopefully for the legislature, although they'll have to ratify it, you won't have the same ability to turn around to a consultant and say, tell us what they're saying. Are they missing something? Have they got it right? Do you have a different perspective on this? And this is not disparaging. I mean, you know, they know what they're doing, but you may just have a different perspective. You're going to be working for different people. It's a different arm of the same agency, but they've got whatever, you know, I used to call it slide rules, them different century now, but they've got the technical people to figure out the rates of the runoff or this or that. And you're stuck in the situation of sort of asking questions without having the full, basically, you understand what I'm saying. And that creates a different set of dynamics. Even starting at the top, is this the right step in the process? And we've seen over the last couple of months, we have seen proposals where we've had disagreements as to whether it was the right step in the process. And so you're looking at a couple of different sets of issues here. One is, because the way Manna described it to me is, how do we work to try to stop things from falling through the cracks? How do we know that we're not falling behind in terms of keeping up with this issue? One thing we will need to do, just as an example, is to determine which projects are subject to SEACR. I mean, SEACR applies to everything, but we're not going to go through SEACR on something that is simply not an environmental thing at all. If the county decides that we're going to reconfigure the county office space, for example, as you know, it's not going to be a SEACR thing. Probably 90% of the things that come before the legislature just don't have a SEACR. If you're funding a social welfare agency, for example, it's not a SEACR thing. But you do need a process to determine, or for the county legislature as well as the administration, to catch it. Because the administration they're going to come to you at times with, we think this is a SEACR thing, but there may be times when they don't, and we might have, again, a disagreement with them. And so the legislature might want to have its own process to catch that. Once the process is engaged, and again, this is one of the advantages that you have, like a town planning board, once we do get the resolution coming before us, you will be able to turn to me and ask questions. You will need to know enough to ask those questions, or I can tell you or Manna, I think we need to do this. So you will have legal consulting. But when it comes to that technical consulting, we don't have it automatically, which means that you folks on the committee will need to be in a position to ask the administration, okay, thank you for all this information. Are you sure that you've looked at all the intersections that we have to? Are you sure that we've... And you can... This is where you're going to need to use your own knowledge of the county, your own knowledge of what they're describing, which, by the way, in almost every case will be more in-depth than my own person. In other words, I can help, but I may not recognize all the impacts because I may not even know where they're talking about. If they're talking about something in Rochester, for example, I might not know. You might know. And so this is where a very, very active committee... And I'm telling you this so you know... First of all, it's okay to do this because we're going to need that. You're not going to be able to farm it out to a consultant. And secondly, legally, you have to do it because ultimately, at the end of the day, you're the one who's going to certify or recommend to the legislature coming out of this committee whether something is going to have an adverse environmental impact. And if we've missed an intersection that's going to get backed up, first of all, legally, that's not sufficient. Second of all, you don't want to do that for your constituents, and you don't want the legislature to do that for your constituents. It's your job to get to that. And so we can work together on making sure things don't fall through the cracks, but my goal just in this initial presentation, before we even get to what all these determinations are, is so you understand sort of where you sit on a month-to-month basis as these things come rolling in, and why your situation is a little bit different than sort of your classic agency like a planning board, like a town planning board, or at the other extreme, DEC, where they've got all the expertise, but they're under a unified authority. So, you know, if a DEC person doesn't think that a particular proposal has been properly vetted with respect to a particular impact, they'll just send it to a different office in DEC, assuming that that's what the administration wants to do. Here, it's more of a process of persuasion and you know, thinking it through and making our case.
who decides whether or not something is a SECRE needs to be followed?
Right now, the way things stand now, the county administration, if they're doing a if they want to propose a resolution, let's say to take an action to build a building, whatever, they will determine whether it's subject to SECRE, and if it is, they will provide us with an EAF. Dennis will do that, and whatever background information they think is appropriate for us to take a look at. The EAF will be, there'll be maybe an engineering study attached or something, what that, whatever he thinks is in the planning department and the Department of the Environment thinks is useful for us to know. The two issues are, one, if ultimately we think that there's a resolution that they haven't presented to us, it may never get before this committee. It may be routed to a different committee. And again, we don't have a system to look at that as it comes into the office and say, that's a SECRE thing. It's got to go to EE. Again, I could help with that if I were in that position, but I don't typically work at that level when it gets routed to you. So that's something we need to be conscious of, and you guys may need to look at the agendas for the... I mean, until we do that, until we come up with that mechanism, there is none. It's just county administration that will do that. Once it gets into us, then I can help with some of these, some of the issue spotting, but that's one of the fail-safes, is that, or one of the catch-22s, is that right now it's the administration, and part of what I'm advising is that we develop the capability to be able to ask them the questions that a town planning board would ask of a developer.
Excuse me one moment.
From my perspective, we do have a process in place at the agency level when we propose things that essentially are construction projects, that we, working back through the Department of Environment, the Planning Department, DPW, and others, in terms of determining whether an action is subject to SECRE or not, A. B is the county has its own type 2 list. There's actions in SECRE which are either type 1, which are likely to cause a significant impact on the environment, unlisted actions, and then type 2 list actions which don't require any further consideration under SECRE. The county has adopted its own type 2 list. It's probably time we revisit that, in my opinion. It's been a while. And what that does is certain kinds of actions, you look at them and the counties, under the county's type 2 list, we no longer have to make any determinations under SECRE. So you'll see resolutions that are written that essentially that the legislature has, that the action is consistent with the type 2 list from the that was adopted by the legislature, and therefore no consideration is no additional consideration under SECRE is there. But we do have a process in place. That does not mean that there are certain resolutions that don't fall through the cracks.
And I'm not even suggesting there are. I'm seeing that's the process we may need. When Dennis says type 2, just to translate into English from SECRE regulation.
Let's let Eric come back before you finish this, because this is an important point.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Type 2 is SECRE ease for a project that, for one reason or another, is not subject to SECRE. It's too small, it's too trivial, it's been ruled to be outside of SECRE, even though you might think it might be. Like, one example would be an area variance for on a single-family home. Somebody's building a porch too close to the sidewalk. That's going to go before the ZBA for the variance at the town level, but it's not subject to SECRE because it's on a type 2 list. And the most basic type 2 list, and the one we're going to circle back to most of the time, is DEC's list in the SECRE regulations. Dennis is mentioning, however, that in addition to that, the county has its own type 2 list, so a project may just fall on that list and therefore not be subject to SECRE. The two caveats here is, depending on, most type 2 actions are cut and dried. It's either less than 1,000 gallons a day or it's more, that sort of thing. But some things require some judgment. And so the first caveat is, it might require judgment and we might disagree with their judgment. The second thing is that, and I guess that's both of them, but I was actually thinking about something that's not on the type 2 list, but they might sort of, might just either assume that it's too trivial, that it's not going to have an environmental impact, etc. And I want to give one example. When I was here a couple of years ago, we had a proposal. It came from the planning department for a bike path through on the back side of the city to basically get down toward the Hannafords from downtown.
Midtown Linear Park.
Yeah. And I remember the planning department put together a package, and Chris White was here, and Dennis may have been here as well. They were telling us it was subject to SECRE, and they made their determinations. My point is, That was the correct thing to do, and certainly the correct thing on the part of the administration. A different administration on a different day might have made, that's just a bike path. Who the hell cares? I mean, they're literally reconstructing an existing trail. They're just paving what used to be tracks, right? There's a lot of people who are not as sophisticated that would realize we're just reusing an existing resource. Why would it be somebody's secret? So they might not have come to us with it. They might have just come to us with the resolution. That's a sort of determination where we need to grow the ability either in the legislature as a whole through the clerk's office and doing that screening, or in this committee to say, whoa, we got some potential seeker issues here, and why are we not... Again, they did that, but I just want to show you not every action is going to be building a five-story, 200,000-square-foot office building. It might be we're redoing a sign, we are smoothing out a curb cut, we're building a bike path, we've got a bike path, we're going to change the crossing on it. And, in fact, when Chris was here, I just to show the type, I said, we're crossing two roads. Are you certain that there's going to be no safety impacts from that? And he said, yeah, we're striping this and we're doing that. And okay. And that was for the purpose of a neg deck. We're talking more fundamental purpose, whether it's subject to seeker at all. So again, before we get into the sort of the specific this, that's sort of the seminal issue is how do we screen that? And then, but again, I want to get you guys thinking about how do we approach all of these, because we're in this situation where the administration is going to come with a perspective, whether it's tactical or not. It may just be what they think, with completely guileless. But we don't have our experts that we can turn to and say, read it, tell us what's wrong, tell us if there's anything wrong with it.
So if I may, Dave, I just want to turn it around a little bit, that we're not the only, the executive staff is not the only people that essentially run to the legislature and say, we need to work with you on with respect to seeker. You folks adopt policies. Those policy documents are essentially subject to seeker. And the example I would give you in terms of making sure that seeker was done correctly, if you go back and remember the bring your own bag policy, was essentially held up because the planning department and the Department of Environment raised the issue that you needed a seeker determination with respect to that. And then we work with you to get that seeker determination. So sometimes your own policy documents that come forward, you need to be cognizant of the fact that essentially they're subject to
not
seeker.
Not policy, but really in that case and others, legislation.
Yeah.
If we're legislating,
yeah,
it is subject to seeker under state law. Now, the state legislature is not, but all municipal boards are. And so at that point, we'd say, all right, it's subject to seeker. So then we give it to because the county administration is going to be our researchers on this. We typically don't hire outside consultants. So we would then take it and say, all right, we'll work with you. Really, it's your ball to just tell us what you think the issues are. Is this going to, something like the bring your own bag law, is this going to have an impact on garbage? Is this going to have an impact on energy use? Because now people have to drive around more and remember to go back and pick up their bags. Where we, burning more fossil fuels, and things that we haven't thought about. They've got some experts there that can think a little bit differently and get back to us. But this is a symbiosis we have with them, but at the same time, we're the ultimate sort of judges on all this. And that's what you're referring to.
I want to be clear for everyone. What is the relationship between type 1, type 2, and neg deck?
Okay. Those are apples and subway stations. well, type 1 and type 2 are apples and apples, a different type of neg deck is a different thing. The absolute first thing that has to happen, and then I'll explain why sort of they get confused. The absolute first thing that has to happen when you get the EAF is you've got to figure out what type of action is. There are three different types. And again, these are based on lists in the DEC regulations and to some extent in the county regulations. Type 1 and type 2 are the two lists.
Yep.
And they're right in the DEC regulations. Type 2 is the conceptually easiest, and so we'll get to it really quick. Type 2 is a list in the DEC regulations and in the county's regulations that say actions that are not subject to seeker. I gave you one example. An area variance on a house is not subject to seeker. It's subject to, you got to go to the ZBA for the variance, and they'll have all these rules, but you will not have to do a declaration of significance in EIA, anything. All those rules don't apply. Type 2 is conceptually simple. If it's on a type 2 list, it is not subject to seeker. For the most part, these lists are not subject to a lot of discretion. If it's bigger than 1,000 gallons a day, if it's smaller than 1,000, it'll it'll be something like that. Sometimes there will be words that are discretionary, which will require us to actually think it through and maybe do a resolution on it. Otherwise, it kind of almost types itself. But that's the first stage. We've got to know what type it is. Otherwise, things don't follow correctly.
In the examples at the county level, is we've determined that essentially repavement projects are type two. We don't have to go through that. And for a road. We've determined that that's the case. There's also, with respect to we've also determined that tax sales less than 100 acres are not subject to SECR. So our auctions, our tax auctions, those have been added to the type two list. And then there are things that are added to the type two list that have conditions associated with them. The example I would give you is shoulders on a road may or may not be a type two list depending upon whether there's existing shoulders there and you're repaving them or you're widening the existing shoulders. And then it's how much you're widening based on the acreage disturbance and whether there's any known wetlands. So there's been some sophistication with respect to our type two list, but I wanted to give you that example that gives you a sense of that how we work through this with the Public Works Department.
So type two is conceptually the most important because that kicks it right out of SECR if it's type two, and it's also usually the simplest. It's just it is or it isn't. Or there may be some discretion at times. Type one, the difference between type one and a project that's neither type one nor type two is called unlisted. That's sort of the great middle. The distinction between type one and unlisted is much, much less important than the distinction between unlisted, for example, and type two, because that unlisted and type two is in SECR or out of SECR. We're doing it or we're not. Type one or unlisted is not that critical, but again, there's a type one list, and so it shouldn't be that hard to figure out if it's bigger or smaller than the categories in the list. There are certain procedural changes depending on whether it's type one or unlisted, but the most critical thing to think about is that they're basically handled under SECR the same way in the important ways, and the most important way is the declaration of significance. And that's what you meant by neg dec. So first I'll explain to you what that means, and then we'll go back and explain why they might be confused a little bit. The declaration of significance is the actual is the linchpin determination of all the determinations that you will make, whether you should be the lead agency, the legislature, or whether they should augment their studies with a new report. The most important determination you make is the declaration of significance. And we will talk about that more in length, although we won't do it tonight because we're running out of time. But we will revisit that either in a presentation like this, or we'll revisit it when we actually do it. And that's when you determine, because what SECR and NEPA really want, they want to make sure that we're looking at major actions that can significantly adversely impact the environment. So the threshold question really is, will it significantly adversely impact the environment? And if it will, we want to know a lot more about it. Doesn't mean you can't do it. It means we want to know a lot more about it. And that lot more about it means an environmental impact statement. And if it won't, then we're done with SECR. So, again, and that's called a negative declaration, and that kicks it out of SECR. So that's the threshold determination or the linchpin determination for everybody, for here, for the town planning board, when the developer comes in, because with that 10-lot subdivision, either it requires an EIS or it doesn't, because we're worried that it's going to cause... And let me be clear on the standard, because it's just worth stating it, and we'll circle back. The standard is if it might cause at least one significant adverse environmental impact. So let's just say between the proponent, which might be a developer or the county administration, they come in and they've identified, let's say, 7 potential things that might possibly happen. And we've identified another one, because not because we have our own consultants, but because we're on the ball and we know what Rochester looks like. And so there's 8. Of those 8, if any one of them might cause a significant adverse environmental impact, for example, on a traffic intersection, and we might cause a significant amount of congestion in a place, you need to do an environmental impact statement.
And how do you determine significant?
The more operational and cynical answer is significant means, is it enough that I want to do an environmental impact statement? But other than that, it's just whatever's, right. It's sort of cultural, actually. And this is unfortunately true,
so
but...
So significant is in the eye of the beholder, more or
less. Yeah, but yes. But I want to put... The answer is yes, analytically, but I want to put a few breaks on that. Obviously, your discretion and, you know, lopping off the top of a mountain and saying, and this does happen, I mean, stuff like this happens, and planning boards are urged to do that at a local level, and hopefully we'll be able to...
So assuming you're not in West Virginia.
but the operational answer is it significant enough to require an EIS, or can we... By the way, the fact that we may end up doing a negative declaration and not requiring an EIS does not mean that we're not going to take... First of all, we have to take a hard look, and very often that hard look might mean telling the proponent to come up with some more data. And this is what the town planning board does all the time, because they have their own consultants, and the consultant is fearless about saying... No, they haven't done. They didn't analyze the traffic right. We need to know about a few more visuals, et cetera. They'll do that because you're paying them to do that. With respect to the administration, this is where there might be a little bit of give and take on that. And the bottom line is, if you think that there might be at least one significant environmental impact, you must do a POSDEC and you must do an EIS. Now, that doesn't happen very often, because if we say, look, we're kind of worried about, you know, the runoff of over here into this stream or this particular constituent of the sewage or this approach, this traffic approach, what they'll do is they'll go back and do another study, and that's what the developer does all the time. They'll go back and come up with another traffic study. He says, no, it's not a problem. And again, on town planning board, we turn to our consultant and say, all right, you double check that. Here, it'd be like you'd have to essentially know enough to ask some tough. We'd ask the administration to bring in the person who did the study, and we'd kind of ask a couple of tough questions, like the weak questions I asked Chris, and get to the bottom of it.
So the lead agency asks themselves the question, is this going to have a significant environmental impact?
Not only do they ask that question, but one of the things that we will do is, from one time or another, I will actually take out the SECA regs, and I will walk you through, is this going to have a significant adverse impact on water? Might it have a significant adverse impact on water? Might it have a significant adverse impact on land? Might it have a significant adverse impact on air quality? Might it have a significant adverse impact on human health? Might it have a significant impact on visual? Remember, SECA also contemplates non-ecological impacts that are part of the human environment, including historic,
like traffic, like you mentioned.
Traffic, visual, historic. The SECA regulations have all of those in it. Might it cause growth? And if we need to, I will be sure that the committee walks through every one of those. So again, so we know what we're doing. So when you make that certification, that you understand all the questions that go into it. So that's what a neg deck or a pos deck is. It's a much different level of analysis than type one or type two or unlisted. The reason why they sometimes get conflated, and this I'm going to tell you the reason, and then we should not ever do this, is that one of the ways that type 1 is described in the regulations, those are the actions that are bigger, and so we call them type 1, is that those are the ones that are more likely to require an EIS. Those are the ones that are more likely because of their size. In fact, it's beyond more, the way the regulations read, which is not really the way it's practiced, is that we presume that a type 1 action requires an EIS, but the applicant can prove to us that it doesn't. They can do all those studies and prove to us that... So really, analytically, the decision for the declaration of significance boils down to the same whether it's type 1 or unlisted. We have, for each one, we've got to certify that those potential adverse environmental impacts will not occur, period. Now, again, there's no such thing as 100% proof, but we've got to be pretty sure, standing in on behalf of the legislature and on behalf of your constituents, that it's not going to cause those impacts. But it gets conflated because some people think a type 1 should get an EIS, and that's the regulations read that it's presumed. I will tell you that the more important thing is to go through that process of evaluation and analysis for every one of those things in the SECA regulations, and we can print out the section if it's helpful to the committee, and well, so you can know them.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. You go ahead.
Just the EAF is the starting point, and it is in the EAF that the type, whether it's type 1, type 2, is that...
I could look at the form. I think it is, but if it's not, we would... I mean, the planning department would do that as a matter of course. They'd come in and tell us.
Okay, and then...
Is it in the form?
It does in the form.
Assuming it's type 1,
it depends on the long form. That's the short form, I don't think.
Okay, there you go. The long form does it. A type 1 action, when they determine it's type 1, they'll do a long form. If it's unlisted, they could do a long or a short form. So those are some of the details we're in, but...
Okay, and then... the environmental, if it's type 1 or unlisted, then an environmental impact, then there's the
declaration of significance, and if it is significant, an environmental impact statement? Is that the sequence?
That is, but, well, that's the ultimate action, the ultimate seeker action, the ultimate determination. But there's a very, very important intermediate step, which you've all heard of. Once we get a proposal for a type 1 or unlisted action with the EAF and the other reports they send to us, the next step is to figure out who the lead agency is, because, you know, it's not necessarily always clear that we're going to be the ones who are doing it. There may be more than one agency involved. Like, suppose they propose a building, for example.
Let me give you a concrete, because this is going to be coming up.
Okay.
And that is the zero waste implementation plan that's in development. When the local solid waste management plan went through a secret process, both the agency and the county looked at CEQA, but the agency was the lead agency. And then I think when we had to vote on it, if I recall, we became the leading, the legislature. No, it's the count. The agency was still the lead agency.
Yeah.
When we voted.
Well, once an agency is the lead agency for a project, for a seeker review. By the way, lead agency specifically means for the seeker review. The agencies themselves don't lose whatever jurisdiction they have if there's, you know, giving different permits. You still give all this, even if you're not the lead agency under seeker, you still give your permits. Lead agency means the people who lead the seeker review. And that's a good example with the county. I stepped away for a year, so I'm not exactly sure where we are with it, but, the RRA became the lead agency because they went through the process to become a lead agency, and so that process is between getting that EAF in and, you know, cracking open the book and getting started on it and doing a declaration of significance.
And we agreed that they
That's correct. Right. So we're jumping a little bit into those regulations and if you saw a training, this is, they'd walk you through all this in terms of, you know, that very dry context. But here's an example. In that particular situation, the RRA would have sent us, because they're sort of putting it all together for us, like the package. And then, since stepping into the same shoes that the administration would in a different context, they're going to prepare the whole thing. They're going to come forward. They're going to say, we think we should be the lead agency. We're formally proposing to do it. And what they do is they send a letter to all of the other involved agencies. And we can circle back and talk about what an involved agency is, but for the sake of us right now, we're an involved agency. So they're going to send us a letter and any other involved agency saying, we want to be the lead agency. And so there are three things we can do when we get that letter. One is we can say, we agree with you, go with it. Just, you know, keep us updated every so often as to where the seeker review is. The second thing we can do is we can say, no, the hell with it. We're going to be lead agency, and we disagree with you, and we're going to have to figure out a way to get to the bottom of this because we think we're in a more important position. And the third thing you can do is nothing. But if you do nothing, that's the same as agreeing with them after 30 days. If you do nothing for 30 days, they're the lead agency. If you disagree with them, then there is a process to solve that problem, either informally by negotiating with them, or ultimately DEC can resolve that dispute. So there's a statute, there's a regulatory mechanism for choosing a lead agency, and we can talk about that when it comes up. But the bottom line is, number one, there is a lead agency chosen, and they will be the ones to make these secret determinations under whatever circumstances. They may consult with us or not, or listen to us or not, but it's going to be their decision. And so it's up to us to determine whether we're comfortable farming that out. This will come up when we get a proposal from the county with an EAF on it, and then typically what the administration will ask us to say, we want to do this. Here's the way we're describing it. Here's our EAF. Here's our study. We would propose to you to pass a resolution to be notice of intent to be lead agency, which means that we'd write that letter, send it around to the other agencies. And for us to do that, we would essentially make that determination that we think we're the proper agency, or at least we want to get the process started. And that's pretty par for the course. In most situations, the county legislature will be the lead. Frankly, this is one of the similarities between you and a planning board. The town planning board will typically be the lead agency, even if seeker's involved, because DEC, even if DEC's involved, DEC doesn't want to do it on a local level. We will typically be the lead agency, because in most circumstances there may not be another agency that's involved, quote unquote, and we can talk about what that means, but if it's our legislation, if it's our policy, there probably won't be another agency involved. In the case of the RRA and the Solid Waste Management Plan, there's clearly a partnership here, so both agencies pretty much have to adopt it, so there will be that distinction. But we will typically be the lead, but that doesn't mean we don't go through the process of identifying the involved agencies and sending out that letter. So that's one of the initial stages.
So Dave, if I can, from a policy perspective, outside of DPW, which is rebuilding roads and bridges, when the county's engaged in something that takes place in the town, but the examples I would give you is the Saugerties Radio Tower, the Government Operations Center, the Veterans Cemetery, whether it's unlisted, which doesn't require a coordinated review, which means we don't have to designate a lead agency, or whether it's type one, the county's policy is that we'll declare an intent and conduct a coordinated review as if it was a type one action. So that's what we've done in the past, and that's what we'll mm-hmm. continue to do. So Tonchi Mountain, the resolution that you have, that is an unlisted action. So we don't have to conduct a coordinated review, but because we're going to go to the town and ask them some questions, we want to make sure that we involve all of the agencies, and we've done that repeatedly for all of the work that you're doing relative to anything that we do that involves essentially a building or something else that is not ministerial in nature and is outside of the purview of DPW. It's not rebuilding or rebuilding a road or a bridge where there's no indication that we're going to run into any issues. It's pretty well cut and dried in many instances.
So let me unpack that a little. I'd like to unpack Dennis's comment a little bit, because there's a lot more there to explain to you. If you have a question, we can maybe take that first.
Well, there are a couple of things that I think are important related to this, but I think we can. I'm just looking at the agenda and the time.
We want to continue this thing.
And then what I'd like to ask, because this has come up fairly recently and is likely to come up again, is a very brief description of segmentation, and also to underscore the fact that we cannot determine lead agency status or request that the county be lead agency and issue a neg deck at the same time. We have to wait those 30 days. So those two things need clarification, because they're real, they affect us. And I can remember when Amanda was in Department of Environment, there were two or three times that she had to remind us about CEQA. And so I don't want that to happen. I want us to be on top of this enough that we know what to look for.
The example I can give you in some instances where the lead agency or an action does not require the 30-day review, and Dave mentioned this, is if there's no other agency involved. Adoption of a local law, for example, could be a situation where effectively you can act without going through a lead agency designation.
Let me expand that a little bit. The 30 days is not a neg deck thing. There's no waiting to do a neg deck. As a practical matter, there will be, because
it's waiting to decide who the lead agent is.
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So we didn't put it this way, but that's a two-stage process. One, we decide we're going to propose to be lead agency, as the RRA did 2 years ago. Maybe 3 years, I don't even remember anymore. We will send out a letter. And then 30 days later, or maybe even less if they say okay to whatever agency is involved, that's when we become the lead agency. So that's the process of waiting. Once we become lead agency through this process of getting these letters back or not and waiting 30 days, that's when we become, if we don't get a letter back, we're automatically lead agency, although we usually go through the process of declaring it anyway, just so everybody knows. But we sometimes declare it even though after this 30-day process or we've gotten all these letters back, everybody says, you go ahead. Most agencies still declare it, because the regulations don't strictly require, but it's just in the DNA. It's what we do. You just declare it. So once we wait the requisite time, whatever it takes to do that, 30 days or less, or getting these letters back, once we're lead agency, again, in the shortest time frame possible to get this done, we can declare, we can do the neg deck that night as long as we've taken a hard look. Now, query how long it takes a hard look to takes to do a hard look if you've just declared lead. I mean, we then would have been doing it even on our spare time when we're not lead agency. But there's no time frame there. Once we declare lead agency, if we have taken that hard look and I walk you through those all those 20 or 25 criteria in the seeker regulation, that we say, no, the bike path isn't going to do this, not going to do that, we can do it the same night, and sometimes we'll see it. It's not uncommon to see it in the same resolution. On a town planning board, for example, the developer can have showed up 5 or 6 times to explain the project, explain the EAF. We can send out a notice of intent to be lead. 30 days later, nothing comes back. We're going to declare lead, and it's a 2-lot subdivision. We're just going to approve it. That can happen at the same night. It can happen in the same resolution.
And the other thing that we've been dealing with recently, and I'm trying to bring this back to real-life issues, is segmentation.
Which is a whole separate thing.
And that's just very quickly, clearly, we don't need a whole lot, but just enough so that when that term comes up, I know it's a hard one.
No, it's actually not. I'm actually really good at 1-minute conceptual overviews because basically the bottom line is this: some actions are complicated. Some actions have a bunch of sub actions in them. We're buying the land. We're going to build phase one. We're going to sell the condos in phase one. If we make enough money, we're going to build phase two. And then phase two involves the bridge over the thruway. So we're going to have to get, thruway authority approval and DOT approval and town approval at that. So when you first show up with your EAF at the first agency, how do you define the action? Do you split the baby? Because it's easier. It makes more sense. Or this might be happening too far down the road. If you do it wrong, it's called segmentation. If you come into with a proposal to do less than the whole action, it's segmentation. The whole action could be defined roughly as anything there's a concrete plan for. So if a developer shows up and says, well, I'm going to do phase one subdivision this year. As soon as we get approval, we're going to build 25 condos. And then down the road, we're going to build another 25 on the other side of the road. We don't have the funding yet. We're just telling you because if it's a concrete plan, if they know what they're going to do, they know where they're going to build them, the action should cover the whole thing. It should cover the extent because we want to know the totality of the action because that's the best way we can gauge whether or not it's significant enough to require an EIS. And there's other reasons as well. So if there's a dispute, but if they say, you know what, we think we're going to build 20 condos down the road, but A, it depends on getting the financing, and B, the truth is, if we had to build them, we don't know exactly how we'd design it. We don't know how many buildings. We don't know where they would be. There's no plan. You can't do an environmental analysis. And we could say, well, we could do some environmental analysis because if it's 20 condos, we know how much traffic is going to be generated in addition to the traffic here. Those issues fall under what's called segmentation. We had an instance of this where we didn't agree with the county administration a couple of months ago because there was a proposal to do the county operations center in New Paltz on 299, and it involved a purchase of land as well. They were going to buy the land, do the operations center, and in most circumstances, that's a unified set of actions because the environmental impacts are dependent on each other. And a good example is if DOT was expanding 9W through Highland, and they were buying and they were condemning land on they were going to do that to do it, which they have the right to do. But we would expect that the environmental impact review would involve both the condemnation of the land and the road and the traffic and everything like that. The county proposed, for reasons we don't have to get into too much here, although we can if we have more time, to break those out. We're going to do the land acquisition first, and then we're going to look at the building, the operations center second. And I compared this to the regulations. I said, I think we're running afoul of the segmentation rules, and here's why. Not because you can't do it, but because we haven't, frankly, it's more than dotting the I's, but they didn't explain it fully, in my view. Dennis may have a different perspective. But that's what it means. It goes back to the beginning of defining the action. And it can change. By the way, one of the things about it is it can very much change whether an action is a type 1 or unlisted, just as an example. You can segment it so that it falls below those type 1 thresholds, just as one example of why we don't like it. But certainly, the bigger issue is if you segment it so that it falls below that threshold for a POSDEC, we don't think the smaller project is going to cause at least one significant adverse environmental impact. But that bigger project, we've got some questions about. We would require an EIS if you came in for all the condos. That's where the rubber really meets the road, and that's why I said. Where, you know, this is a little, the other thing was when they came in with when they segmented out the land acquisition, setting aside the issues of the land acquisition, it just so happened they did not do an EAF on it. We got no EAF, which is sort of the nuts and bolts, the just the facts spam on what they wanted to do.
It was done but not submitted.
It's okay. But the point is, this is. And the reason why they figured we're segmenting, this is a non-thing. We're just buying this. Buying land could not possibly have an environmental impact. There's no dirt being moved. Somebody's just going to sign a deed. And that might be okay, but the problem is it's not just the deed. It's the rest of it, too. And it's a fair disagreement. But those are defining the action then becomes what the EAF says, et cetera. But that's what segmentation is about, defining the action and how much you can cut it down before you start cutting it to bone as to what we need to be looking at.
So I this is complicated. I don't want to get into it with Dave right now. The thing to know is there's not a lot of case law. There's some case law, but not a lot of case law with respect to segmentation. And it's difficult, I think, particularly for a level of government as a county, it's difficult to essentially do certain kinds of things without thinking about segmentation. And that's all I'll say. But at the end of the day, it's the comfort level of the legislature that needs to be
that's
met
right.
Relative to whether or not you can. It is segmentation is lawful, and you need to be careful about it. Generally, we have tried to be careful about it. I just wanted to talk about things that make me nervous with respect to the way we currently handle SEACR that we've had conversations about within the administration. And one of the things that makes me nervous is the way the resolutions are written. In my opinion, the way the resolution should be written when we make determinations under SEACR, whether it even is determining that it's a type 2 action, those resolution should be written that the determinations are made in the resolved section of the resolution, not in the whereas. And a lot of times I see resolutions whereas the county has determined that this is a type 2 action. And I'm like, well, when did we make this determination?
Yeah.
And so my sense is that it's much better for the legislature and for the executive team to essentially make sure that these resolutions, that when we're doing anything that basically requires us to make a determination that we're resolving that's the case. We're not whereasing it.
Dennis is correct, and it's not just a SEACR thing. In general, your whereases are, why are we doing this? We're explaining to the background, go back to the year one in the beginning, et cetera, whatever it is. The resolves is what we're doing. And if what you're doing is not in a resolve, but is a winner or is in a whereas, you're not drafting it correctly. And it's not just SEACR. I've seen those and of course, you know, we don't the cops are not running, you know, I'm not going to be a SEACR or a resolution cop, so sometimes we go lightly if it's not that big of a deal, but that's correct, and we can work with the county on structuring them better. But in terms of what we're doing, segmentation is about defining the action. We should also be doing as good a job as we can in writing resolutions. Go ahead.
Let me just say, I think that's an important point.
I have one other thing I think
to
that,
look for,
yeah.
And also please pass that on. I know Victoria.
I have one other thing that makes me nervous, and it goes back to Dave's comment with respect that we have to take a hard. The legislature has to take a hard look, and from my experience is that we submit all of the necessary studies, all of the documents relative to what when we write a finding statement or a negative declaration. We submit them to the legislature. We try to get them to the legislature a long period of time. I try to make sure that if we're doing a finding or we're doing a neg deck, that we actually put it in a separate resolution. But I'm always concerned that someone is essentially going to take us to court and ask the legislators individually, did you read it? And if you haven't, and you just voted, you haven't taken a hard look. And that's concerning because the materials are like this in many instances. But you have to, as the entity that's the lead agency, you can't sort of shirk your duty to essentially understand and read that material.
Well, let me. There's a little bit to unpack in what Dennis has said. With respect to a town planning board, they might not all personally read the 655 pages that have been presented to them by the developer. And by the way, 655, there are times when you can put a zero after that in terms of what, or two zeros.
But they read the determination.
Well, the point is, you can turn to your consultant and say, have you read it? Are there any issues? Can you explain to me And so what I will suggest in terms of a division of labor, so there's a couple of things I will suggest to you if you want to start getting on top of this not falling through the cracks issue. There are three observations I have, and then we can talk about more regulations, or if you want we can circle back and do that a different day. But the three things I will leave you with are this. One, the legislature may want to develop a mechanism so that we can double check the county on whether something is subject to seeker. The county DPW may not have thought so, but we might think so, and so that has to be caught at the beginning. Otherwise, it won't get to this committee. Secondly, if it does get to this, so we need to develop some mechanism, which might be my working with Vicky or something like that. The second thing is, if it does come before the committee, if there's a legal question, is this the right stage? Are they doing the right thing? Is it segmented? The good news is you do have legal counsel that can help you on this, like a planning board would, and I'm happy to go ahead and sink my teeth into it for you. So we can get on top of all those type 2, unlisted, segmented, whatever it is. I have worked with you at length on that. But if the question is a technical question, can they really build that on that hill? They're telling us that it's not going to cause runoff. That's a big county facility they're putting up on that hill. It's a steep hill. There's a creek down there. I mean, what do we do at this point in terms of who's going to double check their numbers? Who's going to double check they've done the right analysis? I can play. At times I played an engineer, planner on TV, but you don't want me doing that. Most of the time we're not going to do what a planning board does, which is to hire your own consultants. Which means you guys are almost going to have to be like detectives. No, with your knowledge of the county, you're going to have to turn and with my help or whatever. We can ask the administration. Can you explain to me how you calculated the runoff? Can you explain to me why you don't think it's going to impact the fish in the creek? If you're building, a 2-acre facility on top of a hill with a 20% slope, how is it possible you're catching this? And they'll say, well, these are our catch basins. And that way, that conversation is what will perhaps induce you to think this does deserve a neg deck. They've looked at it, and we've looked at their looking at it, so we've taken our hard look. That's the capacity on the technical level that we're going to have to develop. And again, it's because now we don't have our own consultants that we can just sort of order around, and so we're going to have a conversation with the county or whatever other proponent comes in. It could be at times be the city of Kingston. Think about the Kingstonian, for example. So there may be instances when it's a developer. There may be instances. Most of the time, it's going to be the county. But we're going to develop that because they are our consultants. If we want something done, we ask them to do it. So that conversation is something we're going to have to develop the ability for. If there are technical issues regarding, is it going to cause too much traffic on 9W? Are you going to have to turn and tell your constituents, yes, it will, no, it won't, or maybe, and we're going to do an EIS. So that's something we're going to think about down the road.
And often those questions come from the public.
That's the other thing. The town planning boards almost always have the public. The public is all over that. Here, we don't get that quite as often, in my view.
One of the things that happens with respect to most of the buildings that we build or anything outside of the road network is we're not immune from local zoning. We have a limited immunity from local zoning, and it's something called the balancing of public interest tests. And in order to go through that balancing of public interest test, which we do, right, we go to the local government and we basically say to the local government, this is what the county's proposing to do. We need you to make necessary findings under the balancing of public interest tests. And I think there's 8 of them, if not 9 of them. And one of them is essentially the ability of the public to be heard. So the local government generally holds a public hearing, and that public hearing is they take the comments at that public hearing, and then the local government then starts to ask us a series of questions, and then we respond to those questions. So by the time you see it at the county level for a determination, we've generally gone through the balancing of public interest test at the local level. The example I would give you is that we went through that balancing of public interest test with respect to the Veterans Cemetery. We went through that balancing of public interest test with respect to the tower in Saugerties. We're going through that balancing of public interest test with respect to the tower at the Tonchi Tower. I will be in front of the town board in Olive next week to start that balancing of public interest test with them. And so that's how we're not just telling you that this is what we're going to do. We're also working with the municipalities and telling them what we're going to do.
Let me just unpack that real quick in terms of the overall. Suppose the county is doing a project, a physical project. And every physical project we do in the county is in some municipality, some town. And so the seminal question is our project, say we're building a county operations center, just as one example, in the town of New Paltz, is that subject to town of New Paltz zoning? We're basically a developer, but we're also a governmental developer. And what Dennis was alluding to is that the courts have developed a whole series of questions that need to be asked. And one of the interesting, sometimes it's called the Monroe test because it grew out of a case from Monroe County in the 80s. Actually, what that situation was, Monroe County wanted to expand its county airport, and that expansion was going to be essentially partially in the city of Rochester. And the city of Rochester zoned it out, presumably because they didn't want a bigger airport. And so the question was, can the city of Rochester zone out the county's Monroe? And ultimately they couldn't, but the point is the court developed a whole series of criteria. And what Dennis is saying, and before I get into the resolution, that whole process can impact SEAKER, if for no other way, in terms of who the involved agencies are. If the town of, let's say, of New Paltz decides that they're going to retain jurisdiction, or the county agrees with them through this process that New Paltz is going to retain jurisdiction over the operations center, then the involved agencies become the county, the town planning board, and every other town agency that's going to have to rule on it. It could be, if they needed a variance, it might be the ZBA, right? And so that's when we really have to decide who's going to be the lead agency. If we're exempt from the zoning, then we're probably going to be the only involved agency. So that's how. But the other way it involves SEAKER is the courts, ultimately, suppose we get sued by a New Paltz activist that thinks that the whole thing is terrible. And by the way, there have been a number of lawsuits over that particular parcel. They've been trying to develop that for years. And so people there decide they sue us because we've decided with the town that the town isn't going to be going to have jurisdiction, but that was wrong. They say that both agents, the county and the town, both blew it. The town should have jurisdiction. The point is, one of the ways to win that lawsuit is to show that we're going to do a very, very robust SEAKER review. Everybody's going to be heard. You know, the process is exactly what's contemplated. And especially if we know we're going to POSDEC it, if it has been POSDEC, Your Honor, this is going to go through a huge process. Everybody's going to be heard. So this makes this is actually a more complicated situation because we're bringing it to another set of laws and can sort of bump up against a SEAKER review, and there'll be a number of impacts there.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit different.
I think at this point we're going to have do the rest of the learning in committee as things are referred, and also be aware that if something is not referred and we think maybe it should be, to raise that question.
Well, then you'd have to reach into the agenda of the other committee where they referred. You mean coming before us on SEAKER?
And I've been trying to do that actually on the center. But where this came up also was Golden Hill. The neighbors were concerned about runoff. They were concerned about traffic, etc. So sometimes those concerns are coming from the community. What's clear is that we have legal advice, but not technical support, and have to bring that back.
Well, the technical your advisory support is the county administration. So the point is, we have a dialogue with them.
Yeah.
And but then again, unlike the situation where the town planning board has a consultant, we work for different masters. We work for different directors. Ultimately, we're all working for the people, but there may be different perspectives on the best way to do that, as there was in the segmentation question. So we will ask them, we think you need to do more and do this, and they'll say, well, we don't really think so. And then we'll say, all right, well, then we think we need to do a POSDEC. And it's not a game of chicken, and it's not that way. But these are the fundamental dynamics, and that's why we're in a different situation than just telling your consultant, who you've paid handsomely, all right, figure all this out, give us a recommendation, tell us what they did right or wrong, and also tell us if there's anything they missed.
Yeah, and in the case of Golden Hill, the city planning board was lead agency. Yeah, and they made the determination under SECRE. They issued a negative deck under SECRE.
And one of the things that we will talk about when we get one of those letters is, This is your one chance to decide who the lead. Once you decide lead agency, everything follows from that. So if you believe the city planning board should and you trust them, let's just go ahead and tell them okay. If you think there's a problem here that they're not picking up, we may want to put a tickler in that, and by telling them no, we want to be lead agency, and then through the resolution process we can make sure that they pick that up. So once lead agency's out, the lead agency controls SECRE, and there's no other right of involvement of another agency, especially on the declaration of significance. If there were a POSDEC and an EIS, then the agencies can be all referenced. They can show up at the meetings, et cetera. But on an EGDEC, on a declaration of significance, the lead agency is the lone wolf.
Okay. I think this is helpful. It's introductory. We're going to have, more to learn as we go. And, Greg, aren't you glad you went into solid waste instead of law?
I found that being in solid waste meant I was into engineering, I was into law, and psychology all. So it's been a wide range.
By the way, just as a matter of, California is one of the states that has developed its own statewide SECRE. I think they call it CEQA.
CEQA.
In fact, it's become somewhat controversial because, as here, it's often used in terms of questions of extent of development. And so a lot of the same issues we have here exist out in California as well because of their enormous needs for housing and other forms of development. And there are controversies over whether the local municipalities going through CEQA are doing it in a way that's most conducive to the state as a whole. And so these issues are somewhat similar in some of these states that have developed this regulatory capacity.
I do want to say that I think that from the county planning department's perspective, we've been fairly good custodians of making sure that the legislature is on point with respect to the State Environmental Quality Review Act for large projects as well as small.
And particularly for determining which ones are the 10% that come before the legislature that need to come before this committee.
We're pretty good. We take a look at resolutions and make sure that there's some language in the resolution that deals with SECRE if we think SECRE applies. So we do that. And I also would want to compliment the clerk of the legislature as well. She's been really, really good in terms of checking with us and saying, what do you think with respect to this as it regards to SECRE? And by the way, since this is SECRE, Dennis, you're going to have a nice trip to the environmental committee.
Well, and I agree with that. I just want to point out, so for the most part, the questions that we will struggle with over SECRE are thankfully not whether we're missing out on some resolution that's in some other committee that needs to come here for SECRE because they just decided it was one of the 90% that isn't subject to it. It's really going to be if we have a differential interpretation of how tough to be on a particular, they may say, we can do the segmentation, the land acquisition isn't really much of anything, and there may be other things that they're doing there too, just because they, of whatever issues are in that office that day or that week, there are not enough people, or they want to get something done, or they have, it's just a philosophical disagreement. What we will need to do is to be able to do our jobs properly, is to, when it is before us, is to figure out what questions to ask them to determine whether we're satisfied with the decisions that they've made, which are embedded in that 10 pages or 20 pages or 100 pages or whatever that they've given us. And again, as an attorney, I can do that from sort of the perspective of the legal overhang, but when it comes to the nuts and the bolts, we're going to have a very, you might say something like, could this possibly have an impact? They say, well, all right, you're from the town. Tell me about the traffic there. Yeah. And then I'll play traffic engineer, which is not a situation that we want, but I can maybe play enough to say, all right, why don't you go ask them about that intersection and whether they've looked at it.
And from my perspective, I would much rather have a conversation with the committee about what we're doing, not what we did.
right? And so for me, the idea of saying, for example, with respect to Tanchi, right, the idea that we're actually out here going to expand a tower, here's our concerns, here's what we're hearing from the town, that's a conversation back with the committee rather than to say, by the way, we've worked with the town, here we go, here's the final. We're, and the committee goes, well, wait a minute, what about this, what about that? And I'd much rather have that conversation up front and ongoing, so that there's no surprises down there when we start to say, well, we didn't do a traffic study because, and somebody said, well, you should have done one. Or we didn't do this because, and somebody says, we should have done one.
So the two things that we can do there is, one, if we decide to move forward in this direction, there can be previous conversations between a member of the committee, possibly the chair, and, you know, the county administration, to make sure that, offline, that we're giving some advice, or me and them, or secondarily, when they're here, we can do the same thing a town planning board does, which is, all right, we're going to clear the table for an hour or an hour and a half, and, you know, anybody wants to get out of here in 20 minutes, it's not going to happen. And sometimes they're there till 11 o'clock, and we're going to have a full conversation with these guys.
I promise you, not 11.
I don't mean that. So, my point is, the committee has not always had that ethic, because you haven't always known, which is why when, again, a couple of years ago when they were there proposing that thing, I made sure I wanted to ask, at the time it was Chris, and you may have been here too.
Yeah, I was here.
What are the possible impacts of the bike path? Well, okay, you're crossing a couple of roads. I'm going to just ask you a couple of questions so that everybody sees this is sort of the activism that we need to run them through their paces and make sure that we're satisfied. And he answered it. It was very good. We got the signs, we got the crosswalk, we're doing this, and it's like, all right, I've asked the question. That's the chops we're going to have to develop on when they come forward with this. And it could work if we have conversations with them before, or it could work that we're just going to clear everything off for an hour
And I'd much rather do this at a committee level with, for example, the legislator whose district the project is in as well. Because for me, it's much more productive to hear a committee response or concern rather than individual concerns. And it guides us in terms of where we're spending our money. If I'm spending money on certain kinds of things, I want to know that I need to do this.
Because the one thing we do bring in the legislature, as opposed to being, you know, engineers and stuff like that, we do know our districts, and we will, if they're going to widen the lane 2 feet on 9W, for example, you know, or you can ask, you can go to the town supervisor and say, what do you think of this? Right? Or the planning board, right? And what do you think?
People in our community will come to us.
Right. So they can, that was very helpful. It may not be a person on the committee, but that's the one thing we can tell them is, look, we're hearing from people. I know you don't think that tree is important, but let's have a conversation about it. It could be something that they might have thought was trivial. You might even think it's trivial, but your colleague from the next town may care about it.
And I just want to back up, and I don't want to get into the segmentation argument, but we did have a conversation with the law enforcement committee tonight. And what I would tell you that when you start to say which site should you choose, the fact that we've done a very robust look at alternative sites, that when the legislature comes down and says this is the site we want to go with respect to our government operations center, you have a very robust background to say we just didn't pick a site and not look at alternatives. So we've looked at about, I think we're up to 12 or 15 sites right now, done matrices on those sites, done concept plans on those sites. So when it comes time, if somebody does sue us and they say you picked the wrong site, we have a really good record in the record to say this is how we got here.
Well, on segmentation,
just have to back you up on that too.
Yeah. Well, on segmentation, the question is not whether you picked the wrong site; it's whether or not we should have, having picked that site, whether the environmental review should consider the site in conjunction with the building. And we can talk about that offline. But you can see sometimes secret questions are actually in the eye of the beholder, and that's why you might need a perspective other than the one that the county walks in with or whoever walks in with. And so you get both.
And there are solutions to segmentation.
Yeah, there are.
We shouldn't basically say.
We're not trying to beat a dead horse on that, but that's why the complexities of the regulations, we can talk about it on an individual basis, but ultimately my concern was you guys understanding what sort of the stickiness, what you need to, you know, why you don't always feel like you know what's going on when something walks in, and this is, in my view, why. the planning board, the town planning board may not know more either, but they can hire somebody to explain it to them.
Well, this was going to be a half hour. It's a little going over. The pesticides we'll talk about when legislator Erner is here, and the zero waste implementation plan is underway. A consultant has been hired, the idea is to put all that information into a draft, bring it to the agency, bring it to the Recycling Oversight Committee, and then incorporate that input and then go to a robust stakeholder process, and then ultimately, ideally by the end of the year, we'll have a finished document, and then early in 2023, amend it to the local solid waste plan. So that's the schedule. That's what the contractor has been hired to deliver. And we are working on it, and you'd be welcome to sit in on I think every Tuesday morning at 8:30 or every Wednesday at 8 a.m. And we do have Europa McGovern from Department of Environment and several other people that have a lot of knowledge about materials management. But the more input we get from agency, board, and staff, you know, we don't want to move forward until that's been incorporated. And then at that point, we want to hear from the public.
So if I may on that, if I could, somebody could shoot me an email with the meeting dates and times, I would certainly like to try to be at all that I can.
Wonderful.
I would say that based on what the board has kind of tasked me with coming in, that there might be kind of a need for me to go, okay, hold on, give me a second to kind of get my arms wrapped around this, to give you better input maybe and more input than what I can just walking through the door. And so your timeline of the end of the year is really feels aggressive for me to try to catch up and be able to really give good input, you know, input as the representative of the agency now. So I would just ask for patience, maybe a little patience, and maybe that, you know, you understand that it might feel like I'm clogging up your process a little bit, trying to catch up and get involved, but I don't intend to. But I am hearing this and I'm going, okay, I kind of already have some ideas of how I need to come in here and try to attack things. They're already like a mile ahead of me putting together plans and hiring a consultant. And it's like, okay, I got to somehow or another weave my way in here and make sure that I don't miss the boat and the opportunity to maybe help form this and guide the direction here in the future. So,
well, you bring a lot of knowledge and experience. And we could do one of two things, because we have a contract that goes through the end of the year with a little bit of an extension for input in the early part of 2023. We could modify that, or we could get as far as we can with this contractor, but not take action until we've gone. I think all of us are committed to, if we're going to do something as significant as amending an existing local solid waste plan. But when we passed that plan, it was with the understanding that we would go through this process, and that's actually embodied in a resolution and so forth. So,
and my understanding is that is a living document, so it can be modified as you go along and as necessary and stuff. I just, if you're creating a solid waste management plan, well, it's already been created, and now you're trying to refine it to work towards zero waste. And I guess my only thing is that I do have some technologies and stuff that I have in mind to try to introduce and the concept of that may go a long ways to get us towards that. And what I wouldn't want to do is have a conflict between what maybe is already being kind of put together and then what I'm trying to maybe bring in and introduce. So just to be able to kind of look at it. And one of the biggest things for me is just I got to figure out what's in this waste stream.
Yeah.
What there is in the current waste stream, and that's like my first goal is to really try to get that identified so I can really know what will work and what won't. And of course, the front end stuff we all know that's got to be worked on. But you know, the back end is where I'm kind of concerned that we got to make sure we're all on the same page and we understand the challenge.
And the DEC plays a role in this too.
Sorry.
Yeah. The DEC plays a role in this as well. That plan is a formally approved DEC plan, so
if we're going to bring forward a modification that addresses the concerns of that the waste diversion component wasn't specific as, for example, the implementation of landfill siting or exporting, there was very detailed implementation on that.
Mm-hmm.
There was more aspirational instead of implementation.
Mm-hmm.
in terms of the zero waste or the waste diversion. So we've been trying to address it, and the tension is that a couple of our legislators put together a draft plan 2 years ago, and we're still wrestling with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your request and suggestion is really valid, that you just got here, you gave a lot of information, and you know, if we're going to get the best possible result that everyone supports so we can actually implement it, we may need to figure out how to modify the timeline. The timeline for the Reuse Innovation Center is very reasonable for your period of adjustment and kind of understanding the county. The timeline for this was created in part for the pressure of the fact that we've been working on this for 2 years and still don't have a document to bring to the agency to get your input. So I think, you know, our goals are the same, and I think we'll end up having a good document and figuring out how to work with the contracts that exist. And with that, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
Do I need to second that?
A high five is fine. Majority high fives is no reason to.
Motion made by legislator Hansen, seconded by legislator Stewart, and with that, all in favor.
Aye.
And thank you very much, everyone.
This will obviously be an ongoing conversation, but I wanted to give you some ground.
Good to see you.
Okay. Nice to meet you.